I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls, in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. Greg is a former mountaineer who has devoted his life to promoting peace through education. Greg founded the Central Asian Institute in 1993, and the organization has developed clean water projects, vocational centers, and schools for girls in the world's most volatile and illiterate regions. The book Three Cups of Tea tells the story of Greg's journey from mountaineer to humanitarian and has been on the New York Times bestseller list for over 3 years. Welcome.
Hi, Jessica. Nice to be with you today.
Greg, in 1993, you were in Pakistan descending K2, which is the world's second tallest mountain. And after a failed attempt at reaching the summit, you took a wrong turn off the trail and ended up in a remote village of Corfe. And that wrong turn changed your life. What did you see in Corfe that resonated with you so much?
Well, what struck me first was the hospitality of the people. They're very impoverished people. They also live at the end of the road, or say the frontiers of civilization. And it was mostly that they took me in. I was a stranger there. They fed me. They gave me everything they had. And one day I walked behind the village. I saw 84 children sitting in the dirt during their school lessons. It was about 5 girls and 79 boys, and most of the children were riding with a stick in the sand. So when a young girl named Chocho came up to me and said, "Could you help us build a school?" I made a very rash promise that day, and I said, "I promise I'll build a school for you."
Were they used to seeing foreigners?
No, I'd actually taken a wrong turn, and I went south instead of north, and I went into this village, so I was one of the first foreigners who had stumbled into the village. And I also was very emaciated. My pants were ripped. I hadn't taken a bath in 84 days, so I must have been quite a sight, you know, to see this tall Angres, a white man, coming in with ripped pants into a village. I was also struck by the fact that those kids in the dirt during their lessons, there was no teacher there. I asked them, "Where's your teacher?" And they pointed to the next village, Munjung, where he spent half the week because they couldn't afford his daily $1 salary.
Starting a school was in your DNA to some extent. Your mother had started a school in Tanzania, and your father had started a hospital. Can you tell me a little bit about your past in Tanzania?
Well, I grew up in Tanzania. I was born in Minnesota, you know, Garrison Keillor stock, Minnesota Norwegian Lutheran. But when I was 3 months old, my parents went to Tanzania. My father ended up starting a hospital called the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center, and my mother started a school. So in my childhood, I did have a background of service and watching my parents toil to get the school and hospital set up. And I think the other thing I learned from my father was he always insisted on having local people in charge of the hospital, and that often didn't go very well with the Americans and Europeans because they said you need a qualified Mzungu or a white man to run the hospital, but my father insisted that Africans be in charge. So I guess the lesson that people can be empowered, and that's kind of in our philosophy now when we do projects. We first work with the people and we empower them, but we let them run the show.
When you reached Corfe and this little girl comes up to you and asks to build a school, what was your state of mind professionally? I mean, you had experienced this failed attempt at K2. What was waiting for you at home, and where was home?
Well, I was living in the Bay Area in California. I was totally broke. I was a trauma nurse. I did have work that I could do. I was also a graduate student. I was studying neurophysiology, the study of epilepsy. And I wanted to get into epilepsy research because of my sister Krista, who had died from epilepsy. But I was without a goal at that point. I thought I was going to climb K2 to honor my sister who had died from epilepsy. And then when I didn't get to the top, my two partners did summit, but I didn't quite make it to the top. And that's the title of Three Cups of Tea, is the word failure. I use that because I think many of our successes in life are based in failure or making mistakes. I came off rather, you know, without a sense of direction and purpose. And little did I know that there was a bigger purpose in my going there was to help the people.
And you were homeless at the time. You were living out of your car in San Francisco. But when you would return from a climb, you would sleep in a self-storage stall. How come you did that?
Once I made a promise to build a school, I came back to the Bay Area. I worked a lot. I also wrote 580 letters to raise money, but I also lived in my car, but it was to save money. It was a way to save every penny I could to get this school started. I used to also crash on people's floors, and I'm also very comfortable living in tents. This is nothing unusual for me.
You decided to start a school for girls. How come for girls versus for girls and boys?
Well, in Africa, as a child, I learned a proverb, and I've never forgotten the proverb. It says, if we educate a boy, we educate an individual. But if we can educate a girl, we educate a community. And the more that I do this, I'm convinced that, well, education has to be our top national and international priority, but especially educating girls. Educating girls reduces infant mortality, reduces the population explosion. Girls who can learn how to read and write, they often tend to teach their mothers how to read and write, so it becomes kind of a community thing. Also, when women who are educated are less likely to encourage their son to get into violence or into terrorism, and I've seen that happen over the last decade. The Taliban, their primary recruiting grounds are illiterate, impoverished society, so I mean, educating girls has profound benefits in many different areas of life.
Was this accepted immediately in Corfe? Haji Ali was the leader of the village. Was he amenable to this immediately?
Haji Ali was amenable, and it was ironic because he was very conservative and he lived beyond the scope of any media or any newspaper. But in many areas, the mullahs, the illiterate mullahs, are very reluctant to have girls go to school. They feel that women should work like chattel, and they're meaningless other than for having babies and working. So we've had to overcome many obstacles in order to get girls to go to school.
And the Quran advocates educating both men and women.
Yeah, in the Holy Quran, the first word of the revelation to Muhammad the Prophet is the Arabic word ikra, which means read. And there's nothing in the Quran that says girls can't go to school. In fact, many citations from the Quran or the Hadith, which is a part of Islam, specify that people should go out and seek the truth, or meaning get an education.
We're talking about Haji Ali, who was the mullah of Corfe. He was willing to let you establish a school for women. He was illiterate. Can you speak a little bit about that and how you found out he was illiterate?
Well, I didn't know he was illiterate for about 10 years. Every evening he would sit on a little rickety bed called a charfoy, and he had a thick goggle glasses and a little kerosene lantern, and then he would read either the Quran or Persian poetry. But I noticed after I got to know him a while, he seemed despondent when he read or sad, and he would also have a tear in his eye sometimes. So one day I asked Haji Ali, why are you sad when you read? And he looked at me, and with tears in his eyes, he said, Greg, I don't know how to read. I'm illiterate, and I memorize these books. And he showed me how, like in the books, he had flipped the pages every fourth page or put in twigs or piece of paper or marked in the book. He said, it's my life's greatest sadness that I never learned how to read and write, and my life's greatest hope that my children and my grandchildren can learn to read and write. And that's kind of a profound message to the whole universe, that an illiterate man knew education is the key for all people.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls, in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. So you say, okay, I don't have much going on back in the United States. I'm going to found a school for girls in Corfe in Pakistan. And you went back to California and you tried raising money. You mentioned that you wrote over 500 letters.
Well, I hand-typed. I didn't know how to use a computer at the time. So I hand-typed 500 letters, and I went to the local library, and I looked up the name of celebrities and movie stars. So I hand-typed these 500 letters. And I only got one check back from Tom Brokaw, the newscaster, for $100. And And then I ended up selling my car, which I had inherited from my grandpa. I sold my climbing gear, and I sold my books, Black Oak Bookstore in Berkeley. So it was very painful to sell all your books, a really big markdown. Mm-hmm. And by springtime, I'd raised about $3,000. And my mother, who was an elementary school principal in Wisconsin, invited me to come and talk to the kids there. And this is in the spring of 94. And a fourth grader named Jeffrey came up to me afterwards and he said, "I have a piggy bank at home and I'm going to help you." And, you know, I thought, well, what can this fourth grader do? But 6 weeks later, they had raised 62,340 pennies. So that's really what got us started, is a fourth grader and his pennies.
Didn't you also finally borrow a computer from a Pakistani living in Berkeley?
Yeah, it was a Pakistani gentleman named Keish, who was from Multan, Pakistan. He runs a laser image on Shattuck Avenue. It's a copy center. And one day I went to rent typewriter there, like $1 an hour. And he looked at one day, he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to raise money for a school in Pakistan." And so he taught me how to use a computer. It was quite funny. Here's a illiterate Pakistan shopkeeper who knows how to use a computer teaching an American who's illiterate on a computer to write letters to raise money for illiterate children in Pakistan.
You mentioned that despite your ambitious letter-writing campaign, you only got a check from Tom Brokaw, and although you did raise money from these children from your mom's school, where did the $12,000 come from that you said would cost to build the school?
Well, eventually, a year later, I was getting ready to go back to Pakistan. I was still quite short of funds, and Swiss physicist named Jean Hernie, who invented the planar process in 1957, which was the prototype of the original microchip, he called me up and he heard about what I was doing, and he wrote a check that funded the final amount for the school. And when he sent me the check, he just wrote these three words: "Don't screw up, Jean." So hopefully I've fulfilled his legacy that I didn't screw up with the first school.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, a former mountaineer turned humanitarian who is promoting peace through education in the world's most volatile regions. We'll hear more from Greg Mortensen coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls, in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. Greg is a former mountaineer who has devoted his life to promoting peace through education. The book Three Cups of Tea tells the story of Greg's journey from mountaineer to humanitarian, and it's been on the New York Times bestseller list for over 3 years. So you have this $12,000 now in your pockets, and you go back to Pakistan. Talk to me about how you spent that money.
Well, I was very careful. I didn't want to spend a spare dime. So when I went to the bazaar, I befriended some people, and they bargained ruthlessly, which now I've learned is part of the culture in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I'd calculated basically down to the last dollar how I'd get the money and spend it. But there's also a lot of obstacles, like getting the supplies up to the village. And so it was kind of painful to watch this money go away without having done anything yet. And then when I finally got to Corfe, Haji Ali, he didn't think I was coming back. He said, "We thought, you know, your promise was you would never show up, and you did show up. But if we really want to build a school, we're going to have to build a bridge first."
What was your response to that?
Well, first I was shocked. Because I was like a horse with blinders on. All I could think about, I got to get the school built. And he, with all earnesty, said, "We have to build a bridge first. Look at this. How are we going to get these supplies over the river?" And so then I also spent 6 months there over the winter learning the language. I learned more about the culture and the people. But I realized when leaving that I had to raise $10,000 more. we'd have to build about a 300-foot bridge to get the supplies across the Brawler River in order to get the school built.
What, by the way, when you ultimately did build the bridge, what impact did that have on maternal ties in the region?
Well, I only built the bridge to get the supplies to the school, but I didn't realize that there were bigger implications. One, the people could access health care much quicker. And the thing that I hadn't thought about at all was the women who lived on the south side of the valley on the river. When they got married, their maternal ties were severed. And so when the bridge got built, on Fridays, I noticed they would put on their colorful garb and their best clothing and then walk across the bridge and go visit their family or extended families. And for some of the women, it was the first time in decades that they had gone to see their families, even though they lived just, you know, right down the river, but they were able to walk across the bridge. It really helped to empower the women in the whole Brawler Valley.
We talk about, you know, how maternal ties were broken because there was no bridge. But just in detail, like when a woman is about to get married, I mean, she's crying and holding on to her mother for dear life before a ceremony. Did you ever witness that?
Yes, I've been to some weddings, and there's different versions of it. But basically, when the bride, it comes time to take her away from her family to go with the groom's family, you'll see the bride and her mother cling to each other. And then the family of the groom starts to pile up a dowry, you know, these maybe promises of gold or goats or land or sheep or something. And then when the pile gets big enough and the father of the bride is satisfied, he'll nod his head. And at that point, the women from the groom's family come and start to pull the bride away from her mother. And then there's this ceremonial weeping and wailing. But it symbolizes that when that woman leaves her family, often her maternal ties are completely severed, and she will not have any, you know, access to support from her family. So it is, you know, it's very traumatic, and they kind of stage this during the wedding ceremonies.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, director of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. So Haji Ali says we need this bridge, and you ultimately do build it as a means to build the school. But can you talk to me a little bit about your personal health during this time? Because here you're kind of on a mental roller coaster going back and forth between Pakistan and California. And, you know, you thought you were building a school and now you're building a bridge. Can you lend some more color to that?
Well, I never realized what I would get into by building this school, and it was very frustrating because first I had to raise the money, then I went back there, then we had to build a bridge to come back here. And when I got back there, realized the bridge was actually a phenomenal engineering feat. But then I witnessed the men carry 5 800-pound steel cables 18 miles up the mountain trails. They put them on a big wooden spool and carry them, eight men, on their back. And I realized that there was nothing that was going to stop them from getting a school built. But for me, it was definitely an emotional roller coaster.
When you came back home to get the money for the bridge, what was John Herney's reaction when you said, "Oh, I need $10,000 on top of the $12,000 you already gave me"?
Well, he was very angry, very upset. He had leukemia, so he's starting to get, his health was deteriorating. And so he said, "You know, you promised you're going to get the school built, and now, you know, this is going to be another year, and I'm not doing very well. You have to build a school before I die." So there was also urgency on his part to get a school built.
Also, when you came back home, you met your wife. This is before the bridge was built. Can you tell me about how you met your wife?
Well, in 1995, September, I was 38 years old. I was a bachelor. I was at a fundraising dinner in San Francisco, and it was getting pretty late, so I walked to the back. And there in the back was this beautiful woman in a dress, and she had on black combat boots. And I started talking to her. Her name was Tara Bishop, and her father was a mountaineer and the chairman of the Research and Exploration Committee with National Geographic Society. I started talking to her, and 6 days later we got married. And we never regretted that. We just both feel it was meant to be. But that's how I ended up finding my life partner.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls, in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. People called you Dr. Greg in Pakistan. Why did they call you Dr. Greg?
Well, sometimes I'm not a doctor. I was a trauma nurse, but sometimes I would help women who were dying from septic shock after birth, or I would help people. There's no health care there, and so the nickname kind of stuck. I keep trying to say I'm not a doctor, but they keep calling me Dr. Gidek. So.
You talk about helping women in shock after birth, and I bring this up because it shows the level of trust that the people in Corfe had towards you. Could you tell that story?
When I was starting out building the first school, one of my friends, Ibrahim, he asked me to come to his house. He brought me into the basement, and his wife, Rokia, was in septic shock. It was, a very putrid smell, and she had delivered her first baby, who was barely hanging on, and her pulse was very thready. She was pretty much unconscious, and I figured out that her placenta hadn't passed. And so he asked me what to do, and I said, well, we're going to have to go and get the placenta out of there. And then he said, well, I was reluctant to do it because it's a very conservative Islamic society. And Ibrahim just said, please save my wife for me, and I don't do what you have to do. And I'm a trauma nurse, so we went in and we pulled out her uterus, and we also massaged her fundus, which is the uterus. And Rokia, she lived, and her baby survived. What was unfortunate, though, is what I didn't write about in Three Cups of Tea is when Rokia had her second baby, the same thing happened, and nobody was there, and she died. And so it kind of taught me that you can help people and give them health care, but the key is you have to empower them through education. Rokia was it's very tragic every time I go see Ibrahim because I know his wife perished because I didn't really explain the necessity of nursing and what would need to be done afterwards.
Hmm. I want to talk a little more about the opposition that you faced in building the school. While you were fortunate that Hajar Ali was very supportive of you, there were conservative mullahs from the other tribes or villages who were not. And at one point, when you were trying to establish more schools in the Waziristan region, you were captured by the Taliban. Can you describe that experience?
In July 1996, I left Corfe for a while during the final phase of the school building because Haji Ali didn't want me sitting there monitoring everything. And so I decided to find a place to build the next school, and I went to Waziristan, and I went in, say, unannounced, without asking permission. The reason I was captured by them was, first, I went in without their permission, but the most important thing is there was an ongoing dispute between two tribal factions or clans. So when I stumbled into this dispute, I was held by one of the clans as a bartering chip in order to solve their long-term dispute, and that's the real reason I was detained in Waziristan.
When you were detained, what was going through your mind? Did you ever have these existential questions of, why don't I just go back to Montana and be with my family and just live a simple life? What was going on?
Well, I was held for 8 days. I was never tortured, but I wasn't treated that well either. And I first got very depressed because my wife was 7 months pregnant, and all I could think about is surviving. How I could escape or maybe even outsmart or just fight my way out of there. And then I realized after 3 days there's no way I can get out of here. But I thought the best way to get out of my detention was to befriend my captors. So I first asked them to bring me a Quran and teach me about their faith. And then on the sixth day I told them my wife is 7 months pregnant and I want to go home for the birth of my firstborn son. And in their culture, life's greatest event is the first son, who's the firstborn. Now, I didn't ended up having a daughter, but that happened later. But that really started to change things around when I said I want to go home for the birth of my son.
Were there other incidences of mullahs who were not supportive of what you were doing?
Well, I've received two fatwas against me, and a fatwa is like an edict. Both were banishing me from the country. The first one was from a Shia imam, and that was rescinded. with a letter to the imam saying that in the Quran nothing says girls can't go to school and this man is acting in the highest principles of Islam. And the second fatwa was in 2002. It was more severe. It was from a Sunni imam. And it basically not only banished me from the country, but said anybody could destroy our schools and attack them. And that was taken by the community called a Hemisil to the Shariat Court of Law, which is in Pakistan. There's the government court and the Shariat Court, the Islamic court. And eventually in the high Shariat court, that was also rescinded with a severe admonishment to the imam saying that what I was doing was not was consistent with Islam to help children go to school.
We talk about opposition by conservative mullahs. What about by the government? I mean, here you were building schools faster, cheaper, better than the Pakistani government was building them. Did the government ever wish you not there, or did they see you as kind of a benefit to them because they weren't doing the job?
Well, I think they somewhat saw me as a benefit to them. At the same time, what they didn't like was that I was empowering people and working at the district level to get unify people, and then who would on a collective basis go to the provincial government or the national government. And they felt that was undermining the credibility of the national government, which originally was basically non-existent where we worked. And there's also so much corruption, and they said, well, you can take care of this by giving us some money, you know, bribe or bakshish, but we refused to ever give any government official any money.
We're talking about all these schools that you've helped to establish, but let's take the Corfei school, for example. What is the curriculum like, and how has the curriculum changed since the first school was built?
I say our curriculum is far different than originally we had in Corfei. We have the standard reading, writing, arithmetic, and science that the governments require. We also teach, well, at first they speak their native tongue, but we teach four additional languages. And we not only teach the kids how to read Arabic, though we teach them how to read, write, and understand Arabic. And that's a big difference between extremist madrasas. When kids learn how to read and write and understand Arabic, they'll find out that in the Quran, you know, nothing says girls can't go to school. Then we have hygiene, sanitation, nutrition. And then the other thing we do in our schools, which is rather unique, is we have the elders come in two or three times a week and do the storytelling tradition. Because I think the one negative thing about literacy is it often eradicates the very rich traditions in indigenous societies. And I actually started that because of what I saw in U.S. schools. I always ask kids in U.S. schools, how many of you have spent more than about 10 hours talking to your grandparents about the Depression or World War II or the Civil Rights Movement? And very consistently, the average in the U.S. is 5 to 10%. Now, if you ask the same question in Pakistan or Afghanistan in a rural school, they will 90% of the kids or 100% put their hands up. So we don't want that tradition to go away where they learn about their folklore and their culture and their heritage.
I want to change gears a little bit and talk about September 11th. You were in Pakistan during that time. Can you talk to me about where you were when you found out about the World Trade Center?
I was in 9/11, 9/12. I was in a very remote valley called Charpusan. It's on the Afghan-Pakistan border in the tribal areas. I didn't find out till about maybe 30 hours later. There's no phone there. There's no TV. There's no nothing there. And the first thing I had heard was that a village called New York has been bombed and 50,000 people were killed. And then more kind of rumors. And so I asked for a satellite phone, which was about a day away. And some people brought that by Jeep and horseback. And then I called my wife and I found out what had happened. And my initial reaction and the people there was we were afraid that the U.S. would start bombing indiscriminately. And then later what happened was the Americans were ordered or asked to leave the country, but I decided to stay there because I had so much work to do. And I was befriended by the people. And I remember a very elderly widow named Hawa who brought me 5 eggs at the opening of a school on September 14th. And she said, could you give this to the widows in New York who are suffering? And she said, I'm sorry, this is all I have to give, but please share this with the widows in New York. And that's kind of what I saw the weeks after 9/11.
You were very vocal about not wanting Americans to view all Muslims as the same, and this was kind of perceived controversially, and you received a lot of hate mail when you returned home in Montana. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I just said this is a very complex issue, and that the real enemy is ignorance, and that most people there were not responsible at all for what had happened in New York. And then I started getting hate mail and death threats from Americans, and it was the only time I thought about quitting my work. And it was my wife, Tara, who said, you know, you need to go out in public and talk about what you're doing. And that's what I did. And over the years, what I found is that Americans were very generous people and were very compassionate people. And I also think, though, we're way too much living in fear, and we're spending billions and billions of dollars to build walls around a country when we should be reaching out and building bridges of peace, literally and figuratively.
You faced a lot of challenges, obviously, in launching the first school and the hundreds of schools after. What for you has been the biggest obstacle?
The hardest part for me in this whole endeavor is, you know, it's not in my genes to go out in public and be in front of people, and I'm a really shy guy. I've now been Capitol Hill many times. I help brief our top military commanders. I'm a big advocate for girls' education. I generally, when I speak now, we have between 2,000 and 10,000 people show up, and I have to sign books for 3 to 6 hours afterwards. And it even psychologically, I get shut down sometimes by having to do this so much. And you know, it's mostly because of my wife's support. But it does. We have people in Pakistan, Afghanistan who threaten us, and here in the U.S. we also have people who threaten us. But on the other hand, I get to have the great joy of watching a child, you know, writing their name with a stick in the sand for the first time, or seeing a young woman go back to her village and prevent hundreds of women from dying in childbirth. So to me, it's all worth it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Jessica.
My guest has been Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls, in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. Coming up, we'll meet Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India. Planet Read adds subtitling to songs on TV programs in the same language as the audio, so people can read the words as they are sung. Same language subtitling, or SLS, first appeared in 1999 in the Indian state of Gujarat on a 30-minute program of film songs, and now the service is available to 300 million viewers on a weekly basis. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off with your personal history. You grew up in a town on the southern eastern coast of India called Pondicherry. There's an ashram in the center of the town. What role did the ashram play in your life?
Typically, when you think of an ashram in India, you think of people meditating, doing yoga, on a totally spiritual journey. But the Aurobindo ashram is also very unusual in the sense that actually it emphasizes a lot of sports, so physical education is very important. The other interesting thing about the Aurobindo ashram was that there are no exams in the schools. So I went from kindergarten till college in one sweep without ever having taken a single exam.
How is your knowledge tested without an exam?
So the system there is that the classes are extremely small, so you might have about 5 to 10 students typically in a classroom, and the teacher is able to really look at the progress of each individual student quite personally.
So after graduating from the ashram, you go to the Indian Institute of Technology to get a master's in physics. Do you remember taking your first test?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have to admit that for the first semester, it was really a struggle for me, switching from never having taken an exam to probably the other extreme of competition in India. In fact, the whole first semester was very difficult.
And then you find yourself in Ithaca, New York, of all places. You left India and went to Cornell to study communications. Do you remember your first impressions of the United States?
I do. I remember just being chaperoned by my fellow student, and he took me sort of around campus, showing things around. Everything was fascinating. But what really caught my attention was that he took me down to the basement of his chemistry department and showed me this box and a machine. And he took out some coins, put it in this machine, and then pressed a button, and down came a can of Coke. And I remember that was so fascinating to me that actually you could get a can of Coke just by, I mean, not even talking to a person.
And do you remember the feeling of cold in Ithaca? I mean, you grew up in Pondicherry where it's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What was it like to feel Ithaca winters?
I remember the first time I saw snow. In fact, I was 23 years old and it snowed and we were all in a classroom. And all of the Indian students left the room, literally, and the professor was wondering what's going on. Mm. And then I also remember when it was really cold, actually, I had already started to sport a beard. So my breath would actually freeze on the beard, and it was like icicles on the beard. So I remember that as well.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. Bridge, the first time you began to focus on literary issues was, ironically, not in India, but in Ecuador while you were a student at Cornell. How did you first come into contact with those literacy issues in Ecuador?
The project that I did in Ecuador was to actually document the knowledge of medicinal plants of seven indigenous communities there in the Andes. The issue that we were really concerned was that people were losing their knowledge. The issue of literacy came to the fore then because we realized that even after documenting the knowledge in a written form, it was still not accessible to most people in those communities. So we decided that we would actually represent that written text of the book that we ended up publishing in an iconic form. So every plant remedy and how it was actually used was represented visually. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we found out that even children were able to make, you know, sense of what we had put down in visually on the in print.
Incidentally, you were trying to prevent the disappearance of this knowledge of medicinal plants. Was there any resonance for you because you had studied Ayurvedic medicine at all when you were in India?
Yes, my family in particular is extremely oriented towards Ayurveda and natural remedies. My dad actually eats aloe vera, and he's convinced me to eat aloe vera. And so there are so many things that I just grew up doing at home that were mostly, you know, in the generally the naturopathic realm. So that definitely had an influence. But I think what really influenced me to take this conservation of knowledge issue in Ecuador was really the politics of knowledge, because a lot of knowledge is actually extracted from indigenous communities, and that ends up being somewhere else and some other people benefit from it. So our goal was that how can we conserve the knowledge for the people and with the people?
And then how did this interest in knowledge and literacy translate to this idea for same language subtitling, or SLS?
So I spent about 2 years in Ecuador doing this conservation of knowledge, and then I went back to Ithaca to write my dissertation. And typically what you do when you write your dissertation is actually you watch movies to just, you know, procrastinate, really. And so we were five or six of us just sitting in a room watching Spanish films. And this one in particular happened to be Pedro Almodovar's The Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, hilarious movie. And we were watching this film, and it was in the subtitles were in English. So the audio was in Spanish. And at that, I just made a casual comment that why don't they just put Spanish subtitles on a Spanish film? And that way we would be able to learn Spanish more. And that was our goal at that moment. And actually, if they just put Hindi subtitles on Bollywood film songs, maybe India would become literate. And it was more like a casual comment. I said, well, let me try it out as a research project. And that's how the whole thing started.
It's ironic that you had to be in Ecuador in order to come up with this idea. I guess you're feeling illiterate and you're feeling the need to learn Spanish caused the issue to become more personal in a way.
Right. I totally agree with that. Actually, my interest in learning Spanish had become very, very strong. In fact, to a point where I was a little bit insane, perhaps, to actually label everything at home in Spanish. So everybody, my roommates, were like a little irritated that whenever they picked up a knife, it said cuchillo on it. So,
by the way, you grew up in a very literate, well-educated family, but in India, 35% of the population is considered illiterate. So what was your exposure to illiteracy in India when you were growing up?
My mom actually became literate much later in life as an adult. And so I could see shades of literacy even within my family. My dad was totally literate. My mom was semi-literate. Illiteracy was all around us in a way. So there was always this sense that illiteracy is a major issue in India.
And when we say the literacy rate is, we should translate to 65%, how is literacy measured? Is that 65% accurate?
It's not a very accurate measure. What typically they do is a census operator actually shows up to a home in a village and would ask a family to list down all the names and then mark each person on whether they're literate or not based on what one individual in the household actually says. So you end up with people who have, let's say, learned a little bit of the alphabet or learned to basically draw their name, not even write their name, just draw their name. They will call themselves literate. Half the people who are thought of as literate by the census are actually what I would call semi-literate.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. So you came back to India in 1996, where you pursue this SLS idea further, this same language subtitling idea further. How did you get it off the ground initially?
What we would do is, take some, tapes of Bollywood film songs and show them at bus stops, in railway stations, in villages, slums. And what we would do is we'd just plop two televisions, one playing the songs without the subtitles and one playing with the same language subtitles. And we'd ask people to just compare the two and see which one they liked. Almost everybody, over, I would say, 90% or 95% of the people we interviewed actually said that they preferred the songs with the subtitles. So what's happening is that people are getting their reading skills practiced as the words get highlighted, and they really don't know that very consciously. They're not aware of it.
Now, you talk about Bollywood films. For those of us in New York or Washington, D.C. or Texas, we might not have had exposure to Bollywood films. What is a Bollywood film?
Oh, if you haven't seen one, please make it a life ambition to see one. I'm a really passionate Bollywood fan myself. Typically, a Bollywood film will have six songs on average, which would mean that they're really musicals. So it's an industry that has just captivated a large section of the world, I would say, not just in India.
Now, when you talk about just plopping these TVs down in railway stations or bus stops, that seems a little strange to me. I think of Grand Central Station in New York. If you just plop a TV down in the middle of the lobby, people would just run away from it, probably. What is the mindset? Are there people just hanging out around the railway stations just watching this stuff?
I think India, in any place, you could actually create a theater and there would be people just congregating there. Any small incident will get a crowd. And we would get easily 100 to 200 people just gather around the television set. So there was just that. I mean, people have a lot of time on their hands, too.
Because they're not working, perhaps.
Yeah, well, life is slower, generally. And they're waiting for a train or they're getting off a train. It's not like they have to, rush off to some meeting or work. You know, pace of life is quite slow for most people.
So you have this casual focus group among these people in the railway stations and the bus stops and the villages. How do you then get it on TV? Your first SLS program was on Gujarat State TV, which is Gujarat is one of the states in India. How did that happen?
So after we were convinced that people in the villages liked this idea, we actually did a proper controlled experiment in a low-income school. And we found that the children in grades 3, 4, and 5 who were exposed to the subtitles, their reading improvement was much faster than the group that was not exposed to the songs with the subtitles. Now, based on that study, we thought, now we have the proof. And when we engaged the director at that point of the television station then, he flatly refused. And his hunch was that this, when you add the subtitles to a song-based program, it'll ruin the program. And so it really became his gut feeling versus our data.
How did you get over that?
What we did is we wrote to all the station directors around the country and asked them if they would try this out on any program. And we would pay for the subtitling, but would they just be willing to allow us to try this out? And nobody responded, except one person who happened to be the director of the All India Radio in Gujarat. And unfortunately, he was not the director of the television station. But 3 months later, this guy who wrote back actually ended up becoming the director of the television station in Gujarat State, a total stroke of luck. And he basically said, try this out on television for 3 episodes only. And if the response is good, we'll see. He got calls from a lot of people saying that, wow, you guys are doing wonderful work for literacy.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a karaoke-like service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. How did you fund the project throughout this time?
So we've tapped into a lot of various sources, and we've kind of had a lot of patchwork funding. But then we really got a big break in 2002. We applied to Development Marketplace. It's a global innovation competition at the World Bank with this idea. And we basically asked for the maximum that they would give, which was about $250,000. And to our surprise, actually, we got it. And that really gave us the huge break that we needed to then try and approach national television in Delhi. Of course, even after that, we faced other kinds of hurdles. And I mean, this project has been going on for 11 years now, mm-hmm. and there have been so many hurdles. So for example, there was this ridiculous hurdle, I would say, where one of the directors in the national television program wanted actually our equipment, which was about $50,000, $60,000 of editing equipment. He wanted that in exchange for allowing us to subtitle, even though they were not paying for the equipment. But even then, we told those guys that, okay, you can have the equipment, provided you promise that you're going to continue subtitling on a national television program for 5 years. And they couldn't accept that.
Wow, so you almost succumbed to his ridiculous request.
Yeah, actually, it was a kind of a pretty thought-through succumbing, if I can call it that, because what we knew was the life of the equipment is really about 5 years.
In addition to other challenges you faced, you were having difficulty getting FaceTime with the CEO of TV in India, which is kind of analogous to, I guess, the head of the FCC in the United States. How did you get his attention ultimately?
Getting to this person was not easy. So I sent in word that I really wanted to meet him, and he sort of said that he might be able to see me, but wasn't really sure. So I waited about 5-6 hours literally outside as I saw one executive after another just walk by me, and I couldn't get any time with him. But he kind of knew that I was waiting. So finally he sent word that if I wouldn't mind just taking a ride with him in his car as he went from the television station to his hotel. That was about a 10-minute ride. So I said, great, And then I got into the car with him. I already had my laptop running a Bollywood film song, just turned up the volume and showed it to him. And you won't believe it. He just looked at the idea for literally 15 seconds, didn't say a word, and then said, okay, you come and see me in Delhi, because I think we could actually do something with this. And he became one of the strongest supporters of this idea.
Well, thank God for laptops. Do you worry that there might be some pushback that maybe consumers or viewers want the choice to have these words on the bottom of their screen?
What we did in India is actually did like 3-4 surveys to first find out whether even the literate people actually like this idea or not. And what we found is that the popularity among the literate was over 90%. It was just the entertainment and the karaoke effect of subtitling. On the semi-literate, it was both entertainment and reading practice that they valued. And the illiterates also valued, and their support was about 70%. So people were willing to support it pretty much all across.
Now, Bridge, you live in the San Francisco area in Oakland, yet this project is India-based. How do you split your time?
I pretty much spend half the year in India and half the year in the Bay Area in Oakland. What I focus on is policy pushing in India and also fundraising and relationship building in the United States.
How many children do you have?
I have 3 children, two boys and a girl.
What languages do they speak?
Our children are growing up speaking Hindi, English, of course, and then Portuguese.
Why Portuguese?
So my wife speaks Portuguese and I speak Spanish. And I wanted Spanish, she wanted Portuguese, she won, of course.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.